I don't understand the lack of humanity and the lack of a moral compass to do what's right as a country.
Serene, you have gone through college, at least half of your college has been against the backdrop of what your dad just described, losing 200 members of your family, and you were majoring in psychology. How did that affect all that you did at Virginia Commonwealth University? And how did the university respond? Did they express support for you through the years?
I think that, like I said, we've just consistently seen repression across the board, and this isn't just something unique to my university. We've seen it globally in universities. I think that something people need to come to terms with is that universities, although they claim to be, they are not neutral spaces. They're complicit in genocide. They're materially invested in weapon manufacturers and war profiteers, especially Virginia Commonwealth University. And, you know, again, not a unique story, but we, April 2024, many people at Virginia Commonwealth University set up an encampment with the aim to pressure the university to divest from death and divest from Israel. And instead of being supportive, and instead of hearing the students out, and instead of understanding that students were there because they did not want their tuition dollars, our tuition dollars going to killing our people and my family, instead what they did is send three different police forces that night to come and brutalize us. And people got pepper sprayed, tear gassed. I got sent to the ER that night as well. And, you know, we've seen repression in that sense. We've seen repression with policies, again, that they paint all of this up to seem like policies, to seem like procedure. It's not. It's power. It's control. It's about trying to maintain the aesthetic of the university, like administration always tends to call it. But in reality, what it is that they try to oppress anyone who dares to go against the status quo, because the people that are going against the status quo, the people that, like me, like my fellow peers that were speaking up, were exposing the truth that the university is, in fact, not this you know, angel of a university it paints itself out to be, but rather it is complicit. Virginia Commonwealth University, I would like to say, the most ironic part of it all is the reason that I originally actually chose to come to this university is because their PR campaign, Virginia Commonwealth University, is diversity, and it's about being uncommon and unequaled in excellence. And they preach diversity, and they preach wanting to protect it. And then when it actually comes to protecting the students that make the campus diverse, they fall short every single time. I, as a Palestinian student, have never felt welcomed or safe at Virginia Commonwealth University at all. It's clearly just a PR tool. It's just a buzzword for them to continue to get more tuition dollars to send over to Israel to kill children in Gaza.
Let me ask you about Virginia Commonwealth University's response. We got in touch with them and asked them to comment on your case, Serene. VCU declined to talk directly about your situation, saying they have an obligation to protect student privacy under federal and state laws. But they did issue a general statement that read, quote, on April 29th, a group of about 40 people held an unauthorized event on the lawn outside Cabell Library. Despite multiple warnings over a three-hour period from student affairs, security personnel, and VCU police that VCU policy did not authorize events on the lawn, but would have permitted the event to relocate to the Park Plaza Amphitheater. Many of those assembled refused to relocate to the amphitheater, only a few hundred feet away, when seniors and graduate students are involved in a possible or alleged conduct violation. They receive a letter giving them advance notice of the potential ramifications if they are found responsible. Your final response as we wrap up. I know that your dad has to continue with his practice and see his patients this morning.
I would like to say 100% that actually throughout my hearing yesterday, one of the biggest points that I argued was the fact that a lot of the policies that they are saying that I allegedly violated has to start with an event must have a university sponsor, an event must this, that. And something I'd like to state is there's actually no clear definition in the VCU policy. As much as they preach VCU policy, there's no clear definition about what an actual event is. There's a definition about what a major event is, and that constitutes 150 people. And like you stated earlier, Ms. Amy, there was no more than 40 or 50 people on that lawn. Not only that, but it actually never clearly states in the policy that the lawn specifically cannot be used for events or gatherings. What we had on that day was a gathering, was to commemorate the encampment, because VCU tried so hard to shove underneath the rug what happened in their response to a protest, protesting the genocide in Gaza. And we were there to mourn the lives lost as well. again, instead of supporting us, instead VCU continued to repress us. Administration came to us and told us that we could relocate to what they call the free speech zone on campus, which the fact that that is even something at that university in this country that claims to stand on the value of free speech and uphold the First Amendment is absolutely ridiculous. And there actually is a code, I believe it's 20.3 401.1, that actually states that every single university should uphold the constitutional right of free speech on campus, and no university shall abridge that constitutional right. And VCU has that on their website and yet continues to do the same exact thing. So I would just like to state that actually the comment that they gave you has many holes in it and many lies in it. There's no clear definition of what an event is. And the fact of the matter is that the gathering that was held when administration came up to us, it was actually ended. On a literal sense, it was ended, and it was announced that it was ended. And so there was no gathering to actually move to the free speech zone. And like I said, the policies are vague. They say that you can't have expressive activities in different areas of campus, but most things are expressive activities. As we've brought up before, if someone were to wear a T-shirt with a political figure that someone didn't like, does that mean that they are then breaking VCU policy? There's so many holes in this VCU policy, so many gray areas, and I do believe VCU does that on purpose. That way they can continue to press students and hide under this guise of policy and procedure. But again, like I have said multiple times before, it is about power and it is about upholding aesthetic, according to the university. They have continued to say that over and over again. What we did there that day did not break policy. And if anything, what we did that day, I think, uphold more morals or ethics that VCU could ever uphold at all. One of the sanctions that VCU gave me for that day, saying that I broke policy, was that in order to get my degree, they were requiring me to take a class on morals and ethics, which I think is quite ironic coming from a university that lacks morals and ethics, lacks the most morals and ethics I've seen in my entire life. And so, like I said, I do not need the validation from a university that is materially invested in the killing of children, the killing of thousands of people to get my degree. I don't need the validation from them to tell me that I need to take a class on morals and ethics, when in reality, I understand that I'm on the right side of history. There are 2.3 million Palestinians starving, not even just starving, but being starved right now in Palestine, in Gaza, and there are 650,000 children that are at risk of dying of starvation right now. And like we've stated before, 1,000 have been killed trying to get aid just since May. So there are continuous atrocities across the world. So if we are going to speak out about that, and we are going to refuse to be complicit in that, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. And if there's any university that gets in the way of that, I believe that they are on the wrong side of history, and the history books will continue to show that. And the history books will show where we stand, and that is on the right side of history with all oppressed people. None of us are free till all of us are free. And we will not free Palestine. Palestine will free us.
Amy, one thing I'd add, if you don't mind, just a little a history lesson about how long this has been going on. So just listening to Serene talk right now reminded me of my grandmother, her great-grandmother. So her great-grandmother, Leila al-Farra, was actually the headmaster of the United Nations schools in Gaza in the late 50s and 60s. And there's a beautiful story from our family that just reminds us how long the suppression of, you know, Palestinian free speech has been going on. Serene just got beaten by police for advocating for equal rights and for humanity for Palestinians. My grandmother in the 60s was trying to teach, she was teaching refugee children who had been forced out of their homes in Jaffa and Haifa and in northern, well, what is Israel now, forced out by Israeli militias. And the children wanted to know more about the homelands, about where they came from. And so she would teach them about, you know, about their lands, about their cities, about where their families were from. And she was beaten by Israeli soldiers and told if she did not stop teaching them about Israel, about the areas in Israel, that they would beat her more and they would close her school. And this is back in the 50s and 60s. And look at where we are now. Same suppression of free speech, you know, three generations later, right? My grandmother, now my daughter. It's been going on for over 75 years and it has continued. But, you know, human rights and morality are on our side. And I think people's moral compass is going to prevail eventually, I think.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Again, our condolences on the loss of so many members of your own family, more than 200 of your extended family, not to mention overall what is happening in Gaza, your extended community. Sareen Haddad, Palestinian-American, VCU graduate, please let us know if you get your degree. I guess they're deciding in the next few days. Is that right?
Yes, they should be.
And Dr. Tarek Haddad, cardiologist, member of the Virginia Coalition for Human Rights, who grew up in Gaza. When we come back, starvation is knocking on every door. Those are the words of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. We'll speak with the UN Special Rapporteur on the right to food. Stay with us.
Yesterday, but I remember the way things used to be, used to be. I know that it was never perfect, but we did not have the problems that we see, we see. Tell me why, what is the reason good people have to die? Oh my. I could tell you all a lie, but I wish I didn't have to say goodbye. Goodbye, say goodbye. Hi, say goodbye. Hi, say goodbye. Hi,
say goodbye. By Michael Franti in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. More than 100 humanitarian groups are demanding action to end Israel's siege of Gaza, warning mass starvation spreading across the Palestinian territory. The NGOs, including Amnesty, Oxfam, Doctors Without Borders, warn, quote, illnesses like acute watery diarrhea are spreading, markets are empty, waste is piling up, adults are collapsing on the streets from hunger and dehydration, unquote. Their warning came as Palestinian Ministry of Health said the number of starvation-related deaths has climbed to at least 111 people. This is Ghada Al-Fayoumi, a displaced Palestinian mother of seven in Gaza City.
My children wake up sick every day. What do? I get a saline solution for them. What can I do? There's no food, no bread, no drinks, no rice, no sugar, no cooking oil, no bulgur, nothing. There's no kind of any food available to us at all.
Thousands of anti-war protesters marched Tuesday in Tel Aviv on Israel's military headquarters, demanding an end to Israel's assault and a lifting of the Gaza siege. This is Israeli peace activist Alon Lil Green with the group Standing Together.
We are marching now in Tel Aviv, holding bags of flour and the pictures of these children that have been starved to death by our government and our army. We demand to stop the starvation in Gaza. We demand to stop the annihilation of Gaza. We demand to stop the daily killing of children and innocent people in Gaza. This cannot go on. We are Israelis, and this does not serve us. This only serves the messianic people that lead us.
This comes as the World Health Organization's release video showing the Israeli military attacking WHO facilities in central Gaza's Deir al-Balah. A WHO spokesperson condemned the attack, called for the immediate release of a staff member abducted by Israeli forces.
Male staff and family members were handcuffed, stripped, interrogated on the spot, and screened at gunpoint. Two WHO staff and two family members were detained.
Meanwhile, health officials in Gaza say Israeli attacks over the past day killed more than 70 people, including five more people seeking food at militarized aid sites. Amidst growing outrage worldwide, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Tuesday the situation in Gaza right now is a horror show.
We need look no further than the horror show in Gaza, with a level of death and destruction without parallel in recent times. Malnourishment is soaring, starvation is knocking on every door.
For more, we're joined by Michael Fakhry, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food. He's a professor of law at University of Oregon, where he leads the Food Resiliency Project. Michael Fakhry, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can respond to what's happening right now, the images of dying infants starving to death, the number is now at over 100, people dropping in the streets, reporters saying they can't go on. Agence France-Presse's union talked about they've had reporters killed in conflict, they've had reporters disappeared, injured. But they have not had this situation before, with their reporters starving to death.
Amy, the word horror, I mean, we're running out of words of what to say. And the reason it's horrific is it was preventable. We saw this coming. We've seen this coming for 20 months. Israel announced its starvation campaign back in October 2023. And then again, Prime Minister Netanyahu announced on March 1st that nothing was to enter Gaza. And that's what happened for 78 days. No food, no water, no fuel, no medicine entered Gaza. And then they built these militarized aid sites that are used to humiliate, weaken, and kill the Palestinians. So what makes this horrific is it has been preventable. It was predictable. And again, this is the fastest famine we've seen, the fastest starvation campaign we've seen in modern history.
So can you talk about what needs to be done at this point, and the responsibility of the occupying power? Israel is occupying Gaza right now. What it means to have to protect the population it occupies.
The International Court of Justice outlined Israel's duties in its decisions over the last year. So what Israel has an obligation to do is first end its illegal occupation immediately. This came from the court itself. Second, it must allow humanitarian relief to enter with no restrictions. And this hasn't been happening. So usually we would turn to the Security Council to authorize peacekeepers or something similar to assist. But predictably, again, the United States keeps vetoing anything to do with a ceasefire. When the Security Council is in a deadlock because of a veto, the General Assembly, the United Nations General Assembly, has the authority to call for peacekeepers to accompany humanitarian convoys to enter into Gaza and to end Israel's starvation campaign against the Palestinian people.
People actually protested outside the house of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres yesterday. People protested all over the world yesterday against the Palestinians being starved and bombed to death. Those in front of the UN Secretary General's house said they don't dispute that he has raised this issue almost every day. But they say he can do more. Finally, Michael Fakhry, what does the UN need to do? The U.S., Israel, the world?
So as I mentioned, first and foremost, they can authorize peacekeepers to enter to stop the starvation. But second, they need to create consequences. The world has a duty to prevent this starvation. The world has a duty to prevent and end this genocide. And as a result, then, what the world can do is impose sanctions. And again, this is supported by the International Court of Justice. The world needs to impose wide-scale sanctions against the state of Israel to force it to end the starvation and genocide of civilians, of Palestinian civilians in Gaza today.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Michael Fakhry, UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, speaking to us from Eugene, Oregon. Coming up, we look at the cancellation of Stephen Colbert's late-night show on Paramount CBS just days after he criticized Paramount's settlement with President Trump. Back in 20 seconds.
Just 'cause you show
Sin Cain performing at Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Earlier this month, the parent company of CBS agreed to pay $16 million to settle a $20 billion lawsuit brought by President Donald Trump, who objected to the way CBS News' 60 Minutes edited an interview with his opponent, Kamala Harris. Paramount board chair and controlling shareholder Sherry Redstone reportedly sought the settlement to ensure the FCC approves Paramount's $8.4 billion bid to merge with Skydance Media. In April, 60 Minutes' longtime executive producer Bill Owens resigned amidst disagreements over how to respond to the lawsuit, saying he'd lost the independence that honest journalism requires, end quote. In May, CBS News president, CEO Wendy McMahon, announced she would also step down, saying in a parting memo, "The company and I do not agree on the path forward," unquote. Last week, Stephen Colbert, host of The Late Show, skewered the settlement in his monologue.
Unlike the payoffs from ABC and Twitter, Paramount's settlement did not include an apology. Instead, that's good. Instead, the corporation released a statement where they said, "You may take our money, but you will never take our dignity. You may, however, purchase our dignity for the low, low price of $16 million. We need the cash." Now, I believe... What can I say? What can I say? Mr. Stephen loves to dance. Now, I believe this kind of complicated financial settlement with a sitting government official has a technical name in legal circles. It's big fat bribe. Because this all comes as Paramount's owners are trying to get the Trump administration to approve the sale of our network to a new owner, Skydance.
That was last week. Just days later, there was another announcement. This is Stephen Colbert again.
Before we start the show, I want to let you know something that I found out just last night. Next year will be our last season. The network will be ending The Late Show in May. And yeah, I share your feelings. It's not just the end of our show, but it's the end of The Late Show on CBS. I'm not being replaced. This is all just going away.
All just going away. In its statement on the cancellation, CBS said the cancellation was, quote, purely a financial decision, unquote, a claim that's been met with widespread skepticism. Fellow late-night comedian Jon Stewart of The Daily Show, which is also owned by CBS Paramount, acknowledged financial challenges in late-night TV but still questioned the decision.
The fact that CBS didn't try to save their number one rated network late night franchise that's been on the air for over three decades is part of what's making everybody wonder, was this purely financial? Or maybe the path of least resistance for your $8 billion merger?
Stephen, Jon Stewart has also said he thinks that his show, The Daily Show, will be sold for spare parts. For more, we're joined by Jeff Cohen, co-founder of the online action group RootsAction.org. He's also the founder of the Media Watch Group Fair. Thanks, Jeff, for joining us. In these last few minutes that we have, you had already predicted this. You said, "When I predicted the demise of Colbert or The Daily Show, another Paramount property, it sounded paranoid. Now it's a reality." Talk about what's unfolded. There were already protests outside The Late Show on Monday night.
And there's online petitions against Paramount. The reason I predicted this is because so many media conglomerates had already given thinly disguised bribes to Trump to settle lawsuits they could not possibly lose in court. Disney did it over a defamation suit against ABC News. Meta and Mark Zuckerberg did it. But the negotiations between CBS, and by the way, the suit against 60 Minutes for the editing of the Kamala Harris, that's even more laughable than all the other suits. It couldn't possibly win in court. And the negotiation stretched out. And that's when I realized that the Trump side was holding out for something more than just money. They were holding out for all sorts of promises. And one of them was fulfilled when the Colbert Show, the announced termination of it as of May of next year. It's very likely Jon Stewart and The Daily Show and other Paramount property will go. And what's fascinating is that Trump is claiming, and I saw a big write-up of it in the New York Post, Trump is claiming, besides the $16 million bribe, as Colbert described it, from Paramount to Trump, there's also a side deal of $15 to $20 million that Skydance, which will be the head of, it'll be Skydance Paramount very shortly after the Trump administration approves the merger, that Skydance, on all of its platforms, Skydance Paramount, will be offering $15 to $20 million in PSAs, public service announcements, on behalf of Trump's causes. That's really scary. So there's no doubt that there are side deals besides the $16 million, and the Colbert's head was perhaps only the first thing. CBS News will be under the gun. We know this. The head of Skydance is a guy named David Ellison. He's the son of Larry Ellison, the billionaire who's so close to Trump. And they don't want anything on CBS News in the future that will offend our dictator in chief, Donald Trump. So things could get even crazier as we go on. Why? Because over a period of several decades, both Democratic and Republican administrations have placed our media and information system in the hands of giant media conglomerates who have only one value. It's not freedom of press. It's not free flow of information. It's profit maximization. That's why you're seeing all this complicity between the media owners and the Trump team.
So let me ask you, David Ellison, the son of the billionaire Oracle co-founder Larry Ellison, CEO of Skydance, the Freedom of the Press Foundation has said it plans to file a shareholder lawsuit against Sherry Redstone, who, of course, is the daughter of Sumner Redstone, the founder, and the Paramount board over the settlement. What's the significance of this?
I think there's going to be a lot of legal action. I'm not optimistic, but there will be legal action, shareholder suits. Remember, Sherry Redstone, the boss of Paramount, when the merger is approved by the Trump administration, as everyone expects it to be shortly approved, she will be $2 billion wealthier than she is today. So this is the problem in what's happening in our society is corporate universities, as your first segment, they've been complicit with the Trump team. Corporate law firms have been complicit, made all these deals saying they're going to do pro bono work of millions of dollars for Trump. You can't do pro bono work for Trump. Pro bono work means you're representing nonprofits or individuals who cannot afford attorneys. And now you have the media conglomerates who are complicit with Trump. So it's a very dangerous situation. And it started decades ago, and FAIR was critical when Bill Clinton and the right-wing Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, behind closed doors, written by media lobbyists, did the Telecommunications Act, which allowed big media companies to get even bigger.
We have 15 seconds, Jeff.
And that's the problem we have.
Jeff, thank you so much for being with us. This is an issue we will, to say the least, continue to follow. Do you have another prediction, since you certainly got this one right?
Yeah, I'm sad that I believe that Jon Stewart's in trouble. And, you know, Jimmy Kimmel, his employer is Disney. He could be in trouble. You learn more from a 10-minute monologue from these comedians than you do from a month of watching the news on those channels.
Jeff Cohen, thanks so much for being with us. Co-founder of the action group RootsAction.org and co-founder of FAIR. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. This is your wake-up call.
Liver disease affects 1 in 4 Canadians. While liver disease may be part of your story, it doesn't define it. Liver Canada is here for you. Find support at liver.ca.
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.